Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley. I'm really excited for my guest today. He has been a top earner in network marketing companies. He's got a lot of wisdom to share, so we haven't had a guest like this yet. I'm excited to dive into it. First, couple quick announcements. As always, head over to the links in the show notes. You will find ways to connect with my amazing guest. You'll find ways to connect with me, ways to sponsor the podcast, links to purchase my book, what else? Courses, coaching, all my projects you'll be able to stay up to date on. I have 2 television shows besides this show. And then, as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. We are doing amazing things in personal development, so come be a part of it. All the podcasts are amazing. The events are incredible. Hope to see you all there. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality and mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science, diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right, so with me today, I have John Solider. And John has been a top earner in 4 network marketing companies in a 42-year career. He holds the distinction of being the first President's Cup recipient for one company, as well as being the Dr. Bonos, hopefully I said that right, award recipient for a second company. He has also consulted for several of the top brands in the industry and worked alongside owners, top earners, as well as product formulators. He has written 4 books. The last 2 were Amazon bestsellers. He has been hosting the Leaving Nothing to Change podcast for the last 5 years and interviewed many of the top luminaries in the direct selling industry. This includes the last protege of Napoleon Hill, the current marketers for Og Mandino, as well as many of the top earners in the industry. Some of these industry icons date back to the 1960s, where the current MLM industry had much of its design and growth. So welcome, John. I'm happy you're here.
Well, thank you, Chris. And yeah, boy, I got tired just listening to all that. 42 years. And I'll tell you something funny. 2 days ago, I interviewed a guy and we're talking, and young guy, he was like 30. And we're talking, and it turns out he and I graduated from the same university. So when he asked me my story, and I started telling him, and I mentioned where I went to college, he goes, "I graduated there from 2017, which, you know, it's kind of funny. You know, it's like, nice. You know, so yeah, it was kind of nice to talk to somebody who went to the same school. First one of 250 podcasts. That's the first other Seton Hall graduate that I spoke to. So
very cool. Yeah, it's like, it's such a small world, though, right? What is it, like, you're always like 6 degrees of separation from someone or something like that?
It really is amazing, too. And the longer I do podcasts and media type of stuff, it's amazing how this person knows this person, or they know this person through that person that you know. You know, it really is incredible.
I was surprised because I was on your podcast and you were like, "Oh yeah, I know this guy and that guy and that guy." I was like, "Wait, really?" Because I'm like working with them right now. So pretty cool. So I told you in the green room that I don't do any prep, and that was a little bit of a lie. I always ask everyone the same first question, and that is, what is your origin story? So what is it that made you want to get into network marketing? Because I feel like that takes a very specific kind of person on a specific kind of journey.
Well, it's a great question. And sometimes you don't look for something, it looks for you. Hmm. What happened with me was in April of 1983, I couldn't find a job. I was about to graduate from university, Seton Hall University. And interestingly enough, a fellow who I had wrestled with in high school, he was at another high school, but we knew each other through the sport, he came into the gym that I was working out at, and he started to tell me about a direct selling company that he had joined. And he said, hey, you can start your own business for $32. Now, good news, bad news, $32 wasn't a lot of money in 1983, but it was a lot of money to me because I was a college kid, so I really didn't have $32. But I said, Tom, if I write you a check, could you hold it a couple of days? And he agreed to do that. And then I said, well, what do I do? Once that I got these products, like I bought this box and it was like, had some products in it. And interestingly enough, he gave me some good coaching. And within the first 30 days, I made $800, which today would be about $2,500, by the way. And keep in mind, Chris, back then, people didn't really use credit cards. Like Sears had a credit card, I think. I think Visa and MasterCard were around, but very few people had them. So when somebody paid you, they either wrote you a personal check or they handed you cash. So, like when I said I made $800, I had $800 in my wallet, which was a lot of money. And long story short, May of that year, May of 83, then President Ronald Reagan spoke at my college commencement. And when Reagan spoke, he said two things that have stayed with me all of these, 40 plus years later. One, he talked about the fact that even though capitalism is not perfect, compared to the other isms, it is. And he gave an example that was very true then, very true now. The fact that the East German people wanted what the West German people already had in terms of everything from, various colors of clothing to technology to food, et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually the Iron Curtain would fall, which of course it did a few years later. But the second thing he said really got me. And that was when he spoke about finding a mentor. And he said that in 1932, when he had graduated from college, he went back to be a lifeguard back in Illinois because he couldn't find a job either. And lo and behold, he meets a successful businessman. And he says to that businessman, how do you become successful? And the guy said, well, you find a business that you like, and then you find somebody to mentor you in it. Well, in Reagan's case, he liked broadcasting, and he wound up becoming a broadcaster for the one of the farm teams of the Chicago Cubs. Somebody heard him one day, one thing led to another, and went up to California, and the rest, as they say, is history. Well, then what was interesting was I got that message from Reagan that day, and about 30 days later, I went to my first ever real business meeting. And that was in Hartford, Connecticut. And there's about 1,000 people there. And the fellow doing the meeting made a statement. And it turns out that the great Jim Rohn had written these words. And that was this. For things to change, you have to change. And for things to get better, you have to get better. And see, at that point in my life, I thought that I was born in the wrong family. I was born on the wrong side of the tracks. My girlfriend wasn't the prettiest girl in school. Like every excuse while I wasn't going to be successful in life. And when I heard those words that gentleman said, it occurred to me that I had to work on me as the brand. So I upped my reading. I started to spend a lot of time in the library reading things by Og Mandino and by Zig Ziglar and by all these other, people that were sales and self-development people, Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, et cetera. And the self-development field was still a new field then. As well, like people had been in it, like Earl Nightingale and some of the other great names that helped to develop it as an industry, but it was still kind of new. But I started to work on me. So it wasn't really that I got in network marketing as much as network marketing got in me, and it started to open up all of these pathways of self-development for me, and I started to work on me as the brand. And that was in 83, and by 89, I made my first $1 million, and the rest, as they say, is history. I've had a great career since then, not just financially. Money's just how you keep score. It's really the impact that I've had on so many other people around, not only here in the United States, but around the world.
What a cool story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I love that you said it kind of found you. And it seems like that's kind of how it goes, right? When there's so many times you ask someone like, oh, how'd you get in that? And they're like, I don't know. I just fell into it. Like, I wasn't trying to do this thing. and it's like the thing they're meant to do. So I also love what you were talking about, like find a mentor. That's so important and something I talk about a lot. So who was your first mentor and how did you go about finding them?
My very first mentor in network marketing was a guy named Larry Thompson. And Larry was the guy that said, things to change, you have to change. And we're still friends. He's 80 years old here. He lives in Dallas now also. But he was my network marketing one. But before that, I had a few that I didn't realize were mentors. My neighbor growing up, for example, owned a BMW dealership, one of the first BMW dealerships in America, actually. And when I was a kid, he used to talk to me about business, and he kind of, you know, gave me, you know, some ideas that I wasn't going to get at my house. My dad was a hardworking guy, but he was a union electrician, and he had no desire to ever start or run a business. My mom was a secretary. So it wasn't like at home we ever talked about business. Cause
so it was like real life rich dad, poor dad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I had another neighbor who was an inventor. And he gave me some great advice, too. He actually started a company that made a product that actually reduced viscosity in engines. And when he became successful, still worked on engines every single night, by the way. So I go walking down the street one night. I'm about 15 or 16 years old. And his son had told me about the fact that his company had gone public. I had no idea what that meant, by the way. 15 or 16, your company went public. Okay, I guess, you know, I knew there was a stock exchange, but I didn't know any of this stuff worked. And I went down, his name was Frank Reich, and I went down and I started talking to him, and he was smoking a cigarette, he was working on the engine, he's got oil all over his arms and everything. And I said, wow, congratulations, Mr. Reich, and you know, it's great what happened. And he looked up and we started talking a little bit. And I said, if there was one bit of advice you could give me, what would it be? And he said, don't be afraid to fail.
I love that.
He had been an engineer, he'd gone to Syracuse University, great school. And he had a number of inventions that he had patents on, but none of them ever really made him financially successful until this particular product he developed. That's still out there, by the way. His son still runs that company. And lo and behold, though, he gave me that great advice. He said, you know, I had a lot of friends that say, why don't you just take a job, Frank? He said, but I have a passion for inventing. And, you know, I invented this and I'm going to invent other things. And he went on to do so. So, you know, between Mr. Reich and Mr. Somerhalter, they gave me great advice as a kid. And I guess they saw a kid that, you know, my dad was an alcoholic and they knew I wasn't getting a lot of leadership at home. So I guess they both kind of liked me, thought I was a good kid and figured, let me give this kid a little bit of guidance. And I have taken that principle to heart. I have mentored a number of young people that I've recognized a little bit of passion in for business that when they're, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, just take them. And not beat up on them about, you know, read this, do this, but just kind of give them a little bit of guidance. And one young man down in Houston, he's just kicking butt with what he's doing now in the construction field. And a few other young men that I've counseled over the years are doing real well. So I'm real happy to be able to give back some of my life experiences, like those two guys gave me some early on.
That's really, really cool. I feel like there's so many people who like, we all get like tidbits of advice, right, throughout our life. Anyone who's graduated has had someone talk at their ceremony, but it feels really rare that someone has like really grabbed on to those kind of words to the point where decades later they can recite them word for word and really lived by those principles and put them into action. That's actually really impressive. And that's cool that you were able to mentor other people who, you know, kind of took your words and ran with them.
It is because, you know, in life we're supposed to pass along the good lessons, you know, that to the next generation, because the next generation, hey, they're eventually going to be our generation and they're going to have young people that they're going to hopefully, you know, mentor in a good way as well.
Yeah. Someone who recently helped me out with something, totally like didn't need to, but just made this awesome, just helped me out a lot. I was like, wow, that's really cool of you, you know, like not expecting anything in return. And he said something really awesome. He was like, there's three phases in life: learning, earning, and returning. And I'm in the returning phase now. And I was like, wow, I love that.
That's great. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Learning,
yeah.
Earning, yeah. That's great. That's cool.
Yeah. Cause so much of it is like who you know, right? And who you meet. Like it's always like it's often a person who helps you get to the next level.
Exactly.
So I love that you went down the personal development rabbit hole. You know, that's something you and I share. You had like that first generation of guys. So I'm just curious, like, what were some like really big life-changing takeaways that you learned with all those books?
I think the first book I ever read that had an impact on me, okay, was by Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, called The Power of Positive Thinking. I had spinal cord surgery when I was 17. I had been hurt playing football, and it turned out I was actually born with a disease called spondylolisthesis, where my vertebrae were wrapping around my spinal column like this, choking off the nerves on my right side. So I needed this major surgery. I just turned 17. It was 5 days after I turned 17. And my dad was a recovering alcoholic, and he came to the hospital one day, and he has this book with him. And he hands me this book, and he said, "You might want to read this while you're in here." I said, "Sure." And it turned out to be The Power of Positive Thinking by Dr. Peale. And ironically, I was in New York City where I had the surgery. I was probably less than a mile from the Crystal Collegiate Church that he was the pastor at. But in that book, Chris, was something I once again retained to this day all these years later. And that was, if you think you have problems, go to a funeral home or a nursing home. And watch what's going on. And I thought, hey, you know what? Yeah, I'm in the hospital. I'm debilitated right now. I got a long rehab ahead of me. I may never play sports again. And I came back and I did play sports again. And anyway, you know, I'm kind of depressed. You know what I mean? Like, my friends are out having a good time and I'm laying in a hospital bed. But that statement got to me because I said, this is temporary. This is temporary. And I believed in God. So I was like, hey, you know what? I know he's got this. Okay. I got that message that he had this. And at the end of the day, you know, I did recover. Okay. I'm never perfect, but at the end of the day, you know, who is? And that message from that book, Appeals, got to me. And then a few years later, when I got into all the network marketing stuff, I got exposed to people like James Allen, and a little tiny book about this big, you could read it in a half hour, called As a Man Thinketh. And it talked about the law of attraction, that we attract what we are, not what we want to be, okay, but what we are. And that made a lot of sense to me. And then, of course, I read The Greatest Salesman in the World by Og Mandino, on and on and on. And then a few years later, when I wound up coming down here to Dallas, I actually met and spent time with Jim Rohn. And when I met Rohn, Rohn was an interesting guy. I mean, he was a funny guy, but I'm not sure he meant to be funny always. So we're having lunch here in Dallas, myself and two other guys, and Jim, and he would always refer to you by your last name. So we finished lunch, and he's got his glasses, like you always saw him with his glasses propped up on his head like this. He looks across at the two other guys who were in their 50s, and he says, "Now, Mr. Solider, I'm not sure I can help these two guys, but you're still young enough. I have hopes that I can." He was giving me this subtle message that I needed to go and get my day timer so I could take notes on what we were talking about. And I came back in, Chris, and I sat there, and he said, "Let me make a point. Let's say that this waiter comes over here and says something so compelling, something so life-changing, some idea, some strategy that he gives. And you get home tonight and you didn't write down what he said. And tomorrow you come back and you go, let me find that waiter. And you find out that he quit. Yesterday was his last day. And you never find him again. That idea is lost forever. Whereas if you write it down, it becomes yours." Another life lesson, another great little mentor thing. I don't remember. We were there for like 3 hours having lunch with Jim Rohn. That's what I remember, is write stuff down. And as you get older, you don't have to worry about this yet, but I do at this stage of my life. If you don't write it down, you're not going to remember it tomorrow. I will guarantee you that. You know, ask me what I had for lunch yesterday. I don't know. But I can remember stuff from 40 years ago, but that's a story in itself. But the point about all of those stories is that they were all teaching moments by other people, whether, and you as a listener of Chris's show, you have to be open to those things when they happen. Record them, write them down, record them on your phone, you know, put them in a booklet somewhere. Okay. Keep all of these notes, because these things that you hear from other people become yours. They become teaching moments, so to speak, you know, they become a repository for you, for your life.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. I love that you had lunch with Jim Rohn. That's so cool. And I love that he was teaching through it. It just reminds me of like Tony Robbins is always on, right? But he was like Tony's mentor too. And I think the advice you just gave to listeners is great. And I think the other part of that is you have to be teachable, like you so obviously were, right? You can't let your ego get involved or defense or, you know, you have to be open to these mentors, to these great people, because everyone you meet in life has something they can teach you, right?
You know, I'm glad you said that. If I may, can I explain about pivoting and agility?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So during COVID, and I didn't think of it in these terms till recently, by the way, but during COVID was when I came out with these two books, right? You know, Moving Up 2020 and Leave Nothing to Chance. Now, you come out with a book in December of 2019 and another one in February 2020. You don't have worse timing to bring a book out, especially when you do public speaking to promote your books, which is what I do, network marketing. But on the tail end of that is, oh, by the way, buy my new book, right? And I had them ready in Spanish as well. I have a very big Spanish following in Mexico and the Dominican Republic and Colombia. So I had 60 cities I was to be in over the next 12 months. This was in early 2020. Well, we know what happened, right?
Right.
So all of a sudden, I realized that I had to pivot. And when I say pivot, think of it like in basketball, right? If you have your back to the basket, your teammate comes down the court, he throws you the ball, then you've got to pivot on your foot, turn around, and face the basket. Well, that's kind of what I had to do. I kind of had to pivot to the fact that, hey, you can't do these 60 meetings. What are you going to do? You have $40,000 invested in a couple years of your life putting these books together. And I think they're valuable. I think people should read them, certainly in network marketing. And what are you going to do? So I pivoted. And what did I do? I started a podcast. That was the pivot on the books. Where the agility came in is real simple. About a year ago, not even, let's call it a year for argument's sake. About a year ago, I was one of those typical guys in his 60s that if you said AI, I was like, talk to my son about that. Don't talk to me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to know about AI. I know what it is. I think I know what it is. You know, I get ChatGPT and, you know, blah, 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 but I don't understand. I was kind of like this, right? And yet my self-development training always taught me to be teachable. Your word a few minutes ago, which is the right word. And I said, I need to start to investigate AI. I get a guy from Las Vegas that contacts me, like I contacted you to do your show, contacts me and says, hey, I want to be on your show. I get talking to this individual. I find out he's an AI expert. I said, hey, can you show me some stuff with AI? He goes, better than that. He goes, I actually contacted you through AI. I'm like, whoa, that's interesting. Hmm. So one thing led to another, and I got real open to AI. Okay. And I started to use it not only in my podcasting, which, you know, I do for fun. I do it for, you know, contact people, get to know new people, et cetera. But I started to use it in my business. And it's a game changer.
Yeah.
Like it's not going anywhere. This is, you know, 20 years ago, Bill Gates said, hey, if you're not on the internet, you're out of business. Well, now I believe that if you're not using AI in your business, you're probably not going to have a successful business. And I don't care what you're selling. I don't care what you're marketing. I don't care if you're a local health club or you have an international business like I do. You've got to use AI. So that was the agility thing. When I say agility, that I was willing to go, hey, I need to be able to go sideways. I need to be able to go forward and back. That's the agility part of my business life, that I'm willing to still learn new things at an advanced age, AI being the latest. And maybe there'll be something else down the road. I don't know. AI is going to have lots and lots of versions to it. Yeah. But, you know, now I'm actually doing podcast conferences, believe it or not, and incorporating AI to help do them. I'm doing one in Lubbock, Texas here at the end of August. For example. So, you know, if you told me a year ago I would be using AI and I'd be doing all these crazy things with it, I would tell you, no, you got the wrong guy. But I was willing to listen and, more importantly, willing to put my ego aside and say, let me learn what I don't know. Let me be that first year student again, right? Like I was in network marketing all those years ago with self-development, and let me learn these new skills, because it turns out that I need them, for one thing. But more than that, it makes conversation that much more compelling, whether I'm talking to somebody my age or I'm talking to somebody, you know, 40 years younger on one of my shows that is using AI every single day and could use it in their sleep. So, you know, pivoting and agility in all businesses is absolutely necessary because we live in an ever-changing world, you know, bottom line.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought all of that up. It's so important, and not even just in business, in your personal life too, right? Persistence and the idea that you can adapt, right? And yeah, AI is the future. And I don't know about you, but at this point, I don't even use Google anymore. I just use ChatGPT. And you could use it for everything. Like, yes, podcasts, for business, for marketing. Like, it's great for writing emails and ads. But I also use it for personal development stuff. I've had my whole book uploaded to ChatGPT, and it knows like everything I'm manifesting and everything my husband's manifesting. And so every night it spits out a little story of a day in our future life, and it just like little things like that. And it's so cool. And actually, one thing I did with it the other day that was so helpful is I was like, okay, you know, take everything you know about me, all of our interactions, and tell me what some of my blind spots are. Like, where do I need to grow? And it totally nailed me. And then it gave me like little tips on how to work on those things. And it's so incredible. Like, everyone should be using AI.
Exactly. Well, it's funny, you know, when I started using it, I was like, well, who programs the AI? And then I found out about these machine learning engineers. And my son's in the process of becoming an electrical engineer. He's a real smart kid. I started talking to him about it. He goes, Dad, picture the guys I hang out with on steroids. He goes, that's the machine learning engineers. He goes, they're like the smartest of the smart because they're actually the ones programming the robots with all of this data that they're constantly, you know, pulling from all these different sources. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, we're living at a great time. I mean, you know, on the one hand, I watched the news today, like you probably did, Chris, and I don't know when you're going to air this, but, you know, we're watching a new war breaking out between the Israelis and the Iranians and, you know, all the other stuff, the social unrest in our own country. And those things make me so sad, because we're living at this incredible time for not only here, you know, us here in America, but throughout the world, of all of these technological breakthroughs that are going to help in science, they're going to help in healthcare, they're going to help in financial situations, they're going to help in so many things. We just got to stop killing each other and get real smart about, hey, let's get on the same page that humanity needs to work arm in arm with one another, you know, to have a better world. And I think there's a lot of people on that page. I think there's more people on that page than on the other pages, frankly. But yeah, we all got to get on those pages that, you know, we got all of these great and wonderful things that have been created. You know, I know in the medical world, I talk to a lot of doctors on a regular basis, and some of the breakthroughs in science that have just happened in the last couple of years using AI.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And where is it going to be in 5-10 years down the road? Yeah, you know, so there's so many great things happening. We got to keep our, as luminators of self-development like you are and I am, we got to keep people on the right track that, hey, the best is ahead of humanity, not behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with that. It's like, we are living in such an exciting time, and also a time when science is backing up what spirituality says, right? We have things like neuroscience and epigenetics and quantum physics converging with spirituality. And it's so exciting. And there's so many enriching conversations to have. And I think what you said, you know, those people who are leading the path on personal development, it's so important, because our inner world creates our outer world, right? Angry people can't create a peaceful world. So people have to do their own inner work for us as a collective to be a peaceful civilization. And yeah, you know, I do hope that there's something big that happens that unites us. I was hoping it was the pandemic, but maybe that was just kind of the start of it. And as for AI, like, I think about that all the time. I have a toddler. I'm like, wow, he's not going to know what it's like to live without AI.
Yeah.
Exactly. What a crazy thing.
Yeah, I'll be using it in kindergarten probably, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild. Yeah, like my generation, I'm turning 40 this year, and my generation was the last one to grow up without the internet, but also have the internet. Like it kind of came when I was in like junior high-ish. So yeah, that's even like such a trippy thing to think about, right? Life before the internet.
Well, I tell people all the time, it's like when I started my first business in 83, you know, my telephone plugged into the wall.
Yeah.
And a few years later, they started to make the phones that you could wander, like, I forget, like 20 feet from the base, and you couldn't hear well. Sometimes they'd break out. Now, you think today, I mean, just the technology we're on, I'm in my house in Dallas, you're in your house in California, you know, we got phones that we could launch a space shuttle with. I mean, it's just incredible what's happened. And that's really not that long a period of time compared to the expanse of time, you know, if you go back historically, right? So we're like, all these great things are happening. And what we got to just learn to do is just, you know, yeah, just kind of like take a deep breath and give other people a chance for one thing. But at the same time, realize that, hey, all of these things that have been created are for us to use. And you're right. It is supporting spirituality, because, you know, where does it all come from? You know what I mean? Where does thought come from? I mean, just in terms of the brain, you know, I may be wrong on my numbers, so if I am, I apologize. But I've been told that most people use 12% of their brain mass. That people like Einstein and Max Planck and people like that used like 14%. So you look at that and you go, if even the smartest people that walk the planet only used 14%, so 86% they didn't use. So when we think about how conscious people are going to become as we learn more about the brain and how to utilize it, you know, what's going to be around, you know, 40 years from now? I won't be here probably, realistically, right? And if I am, I probably won't know I'm here. But, you know, to that point, when I look at what's happened over these last 40 years, you know, I remember when I got my first fax machine, for example. I had it in my kitchen in my house in New York, and I got my first fax from an ad that I ran in Montreal. And I said to my wife, I'm like, how in the world do we live without this? Well, those how in the world that we live without this inventions haven't really been created yet. And yet look at where we are, right? So, I mean, it's very, very exciting if we just stop killing each other long enough to take advantage of all this stuff and grow as people rather than hurt each other.
Yeah, totally. And also like understand that we're part of a collective, right? Like if you, all this like us versus them, right versus wrong is just ego bullshit, right? Like we can't like hurt another person without hurting ourselves, right? It's all interconnected. So I really do hope we start to collaborate and understand like we're in this together. So
I think in some respects, the world's closer to that than it has been before.
I think so too.
But having said that, it's still so many things are driven by politics, you know, and money. And you know, unfortunately, and, you know, so at some point, you know, my son got me watching this kind of silly show called Orville a couple months ago. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Mm-mm.
Kind of like Star Trek. The guy that did Family Guy is the writer of it. I'm going to forget his name. McFarlane.
Okay. Seth MacFarlane.
Yeah, Seth MacFarlane. And at first I was like, well, this is going to be goofy, but yeah, they're in a civilization where there's now like no politics, countries, like the world is like this place with like, you know, 50 planets, et cetera, et cetera. They have planetary councils to discuss things, right? And it's kind of wild. And at first you watch it, you're like, it's kind of goofy. But then you're saying, you know, maybe they got the right idea.
Mm.
They got rules where it's like, hey, you know, we're not going to attack each other. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. We're going to work things out, you know? So hopefully that's where the world will get to. I mean, you know, probably not in my lifetime, maybe not even in yours, Chris, but hopefully in your kids and my grandkids' lifetimes where people realize it's easier to work together and collaborate than it is to, you know, fight about things that probably in the long run aren't all that important.
Yeah. I mean, I hope it happens in our lifetimes. Never know, it might. But yeah, I love that vision. And you're right, like politics drives so much. Like I know so many people who are, you know, so open-minded and so spiritual and they meditate every day. And then it's like, I look at their Facebook page and they're just like, there's so much anger and hatred towards like the other political party. And it's like, well, wait, you can't like meditate and be at peace and then like get up and like forget all that and just like start like blasting people online for having a different view. So it's, yeah, it sucks.
Exactly. Well, hopefully, yeah. I mean, I got to the point, I don't even post anything political because I got friends on both sides of stuff. You know, I've got my opinions on stuff, but I think too, what's happened with politics is, you know, it used to be Democrat, Republican in this country. Now there's factions within both parties that are so far left or so far right that you disagree with, even if you vote for the same candidate as some of those people, but you meet some of them. And I'll just give you one example. I mean, I went vegan a year and a half ago, and I've been veg for 8 years, right? And I had a little pig on my birthday 2 weeks ago. I came out of the movie theater, and there was a lady selling these little piglets. So I held one, little baby pig about this big, and he was making a noise, so I started petting him under his chin. He fell asleep in my arms, my wife.
Sweetheart. Aww.
So I posted on Facebook, and by the way, I'm not telling everybody you need to become vegetarian, so don't write to me and tell me, you know, I'll tell you how to eat. But anyway, long story short, I said, hey, this is how 8 years ago I became vegetarian. I started to realize, like, these are sentient beings. Like, I don't need my bacon that bad. I had a guy literally attack me. I mean, attack, like a total stranger on Facebook. And I mean, not attack me like he wanted to debate me, because I even said to him, hey, why don't you come on my show and let's have a debate? You bring your science, I'll bring my science. Didn't go for that. Just like vitriol, swearing at me because of how I choose to eat. Like, how silly is that? And by the way, I'm talking a total stranger. I don't even know this man. So I got him off my Facebook. But my only point about that is, what is he really angry at? He doesn't even know me. He's not angry at me. He doesn't even know me.
Yeah.
Right? But they find some little thing that you put out there that they vehemently disagree with, and they choose to, you know, get on a soapbox and attack you for it and want you to go back at them. So it becomes, you know, this tennis match of anger. And it's like, nah, I didn't take the bait. I said to my wife, let's just delete this guy, which we did, you know. So he's deleted.
Blocked.
Yep, he's gone.
Yeah, I think when people lash out like that, they're coming from their own pain and their own fear. I posted a reel maybe like a year ago, and I was just like, you know, for people who are internet trolls or like the keyboard warriors, like, what do you get out of it? You know, like, and it was amazing. This one guy on YouTube gave me like the most honest answer. He was like, it makes me feel better. He's like, when I'm feeling shitty, it makes me feel better. And I was like, wow, thank you for your honesty. But it just goes to show, like, hurt people, right? And again, like, people who lash out like that or are angry, like, outside things don't make them angry. They're already angry, and outside things give them an excuse to, like, vent that onto the world, right? So that they don't, like, boil over. So yeah, it's good that you know that has nothing to do with you.
No, they just, you know, people just need to learn how to breathe. And I won't say I always was that way. I mean, I took the bait earlier on in you know, with Facebook years ago. But now it's sure. Like, I have a buddy that played for the Green Bay Packers. And he is just like, some of the stuff he posts. And I'm like, Tim, what are you thinking? Like, you played professional football. Like you were like a man's man, and you put stuff up there sometimes, and it's like you're like attacking like little girls and stuff and saying crazy stuff. And then finally he came back to me, like you said. He said, I'm in so much pain. I go, yeah, but don't try to put other people in pain, because you're a better man than that. You know what I mean? And you know, so like I said, sometimes people just, I think they just want to fight for the sake of fighting. They don't even know what they're fighting about. Like, if you want to fight up based on principle, like I said, like with this guy, if he came on my show, I would have heard him out. Give me your point of view. I'll give you mine.
Yeah.
And like, we could be friends. Like, and then we could go out, you can have a hamburger and I'll have a veggie burger, you know, like, but you know, you don't want to do that. You want to instead like, I mean, I won't even say on your show, but when some of the stuff he said to me, I was like, if this guy was in the same room with me, he never would have said this stuff.
Yeah, totally. Right. You feel like emboldened, anonymous behind a screen.
Exactly. Yeah. They're keyboard warriors, you know? So anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like one of the biggest lessons I've learned in life is that what other people say about me and do to me says so much more about them than it does about me.
Exactly.
And it was a really hard lesson to learn. But once you get that, it's pretty freeing.
Yeah, well, you're right. And you know what? A lot of times, like you said, I mean, it's their anger about something totally unrelated to you personally. And, you know, you just let them rattle on and move on from it. You know, like I said, I don't take the bait, you know, from people. You know, I'd much rather talk about AI, podcasting, clip farming, building businesses, building companies, building sales organizations, doing things that are productive, not only for me, but for other people that I can teach them, that can bless people, as opposed to just being angry because, you know, I love Donald Trump. I hate Donald Trump. You really think Donald Trump cares? He's got a big job to do one way or another. He's got his own problems. You know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, or Joe Biden or whomever's in office at the time, you know, like, and I met years ago, I was on a board for a company here in Dallas, and I wound up going to some events in Washington, and I met some politicians. And I got to tell you, most of them don't care about their constituency at all. Okay, they care about you when it's time to raise money. Otherwise, they don't know you're alive. And I got to know some of them, and I was like, you know, and I get it, and it doesn't make them bad people either. I'll even defend them. What it is that their job is to get reelected and stay in power because that's how they pay their bills. It's a job.
Yeah.
And when you see it through that lens, you realize they're going to say and do what they have to do to appease the people who are going to keep them in power because, hey, let's face it, it's a good paying job with a lot of benefits. I wouldn't want to lose it either. So, you know, they're playing defense for their own reasons, which has nothing necessarily to do with you as the voter, you know. So if you realize that, you kind of calm down on these things and you realize it's a business too.
Yeah, totally. I think anyone that doesn't understand that is just kind of got the rose-colored glasses on, right? Like, of course they don't. But then you have, like, I'm a big RFK Jr. fan. You know, we don't have to get into politics, but I'm like, someone out there is like trying to do good at least, right? Like, I don't know. So there's still the good people out there, I think.
Well, somewhere here, yeah. I mean, the show I occasionally host on Top Doctor, RFK was on the cover about 2 months ago. So
I'm surprised. Was it in a positive light?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he wrote the article.
Okay.
He's smart like that. He's not going to let anybody else write it. But, yeah, I share your likeness of him. I actually wish that or hopefully that, you know, maybe he takes a run here in 2028. We'll see.
He's got my vote if he does.
Well, you know what's funny? I mean, can we talk about podcasting for a minute? What's funny is if you look at this media that you and I are both part of podcasters across, you know, the United States and the world, in the English-speaking market now, there's over 4 million English-speaking podcasts. That number's grown from 3.7 million about six wow. months ago. But here's the other thing that's interesting. Trump got on over 100 podcasts. Kamala Harris got on 4. Now, what's my point on that, okay, is his son, Barron, I guess, had told him, hey, Dad, you know what? 18 to 35-year-olds are not watching Fox, MSNBC, or CNN. And I started thinking about that from this standpoint. None of my three kids own televisions. Now, my two kids that live with me and go to school here, they don't even watch TV. If my son wants to watch a ball game, like, you know, once in a while he'll watch a football game or hockey game, he watches it on his computer. So they're not even turning into those three networks that we think, you know, at my age anyway, we think those are the three sources of news. The reality is that 18 to 35-year-old metric, they're not listening to that, but what are they listening to? Podcasts. So as we get to 2028 and beyond, I think we're going to see more political candidates get on podcasts and say, hey, let me talk to your 500 followers, 1,000 or whatever you've got that religiously listen to your show. Let me tell you what I stand for or don't stand for that matter. And, you know, they can make their decisions. So I think we're going to see this media explode the next, you know, 5-10 years.
Totally. Because it's independent media. It's not bought by whoever. Everyone understands. Okay. I love, and I guess I'll keep talking politics. I love that Bernie Sanders and someone else just proposed that new bill. And this is probably going to be like so outdated by the time I post this. they just proposed a new bill to take off pharma ads from TV, from social media, from I think the internet in general, which would be huge because pharma buys like 80% of the ads for CNN and Fox and CNBC and MSNBC. So those stations are so bought out that they can't report things objectively. Right. And I think everyone knows that, right? Everyone knows that there's an agenda. So people my age and younger are going to these independent news sources. Like I'm a big Joe Rogan fan. And like, I think if Kamala would have gone on Joe Rogan, she might've done a lot better.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I mean, I think in a big way, I think he helped win Trump the election.
Joe's got a huge following.
Yeah.
One, and number two, the long form. I mean, people want the shorts, right? I mean, I do shorts, you do shorts, we all do shorts, right, for our shows. But at the end of the day, long form, you really get to know somebody that maybe you didn't know them previously, you know? So I think, like I said, I could be wrong. Wouldn't be the first time. But I think you're going to see a lot of candidates reaching out to people like us and just saying, hey, let me get on your show because, you know, whatever you have 500 followers, 1,000 followers that are religiously listening to your show, guess what? If I can't talk to them otherwise, and you look at these elections, I mean, they're razor thin in terms of who wins. The last three or four presidential elections have been, you know, margin of error. Going back to Bush 2 and Gore, I mean, you know, you're talking, I think it was a couple thousand votes in Florida.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
The election. So to that point, it's not like, well, I need to go only to Joe Rogan, who's got millions of people listening. I better go to the person who's got an audience that listens on a regular basis, you know, and Bobby Kennedy has figured that out. Bobby's been on a lot of these shows, you know, and he reaches out to groups that are otherwise, you know, small groups. They might be part of other larger groups, but he talks to small groups all the time. I heard him speak in New York a few years ago, for like 20 boat owners when he was working on the Hudson River project. And I learned something from him that day. That was magic. And I think he learned it from his dad and from his Uncle Jack. And that was that the boat owners love the Hudson River for one reason, that you can run a powerboat on it. Conversely, there were people that did a lot of hiking and even foraging, you know, for vegetables and fruits that would grow along the Hudson River. Anyway, he has this group on a Sunday afternoon. There's only like 20 of us. And you walk in, and it's like the one side of the room are like the people in like Birkenstocks, right, with their hair braids. They're sitting on one side. The boat owners, you could tell, they're sitting on the other side. And what was so amazing is he made this appeal where he said, we all love the river for the same reasons. And he spelled them out like I just did. And Chris, that 45-minute to an hour talk that he made, at the end of that, they had, you know, coffee and cookies and stuff. All of a sudden, I'm watching people who normally wouldn't cross the aisle to talk to a person different than them, right? That each side would judge, you know, the other side. Well, either their politics are different or they're so different than I am. And all of a sudden, you were watching hunters and fishermen and Birkenstock people just talking like you and I are right now, just having a conversation. Maybe it wasn't even about what Kennedy talked about. Maybe it was about the weather. I don't know. But I watched that dynamic, and I'm like, that's what we got to get back to in the world, not just here in America, but throughout the world. It's just talking to each other instead of at each other.
I love that so much. And it goes to show, like, we have so much more in common than we do apart. Like, most people just want to, like, live a safe life and be happy and prosper and have security and be with their family and make a difference. You know, like, everyone kind of wants those same core things.
You know, I was having lunch today with a friend of mine and his wife and my wife. And one of the guys I used to play jiu-jitsu with, he's got a jiu-jitsu school here in Dallas. He's a Persian American. He's American citizen now. He's originally from Iran. So I called him just to inquire. I know his mom's over there and some other family members, just to make sure that they were okay.
Yeah.
Now, I also lived in Tel Aviv 26 years ago.
I didn't know that.
Okay, so at the end of the day, I've got friends on that side too, right? And you're like, you know what? Here's what I know. You know, when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. Who's going to get trampled in this thing? The little people again, right? The moms and the cousins of people that you know, are probably just in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know? So hope and pray for the best with that situation. But my point is, whether it's there or the Russians and the Ukrainians, or, you know, go down the list, is, you know, we as human beings, if we talk to each other instead of at each other, we're going to be better. I'll give you one fast example of that. My daughter, as you know, lives in LA, and I was out there last September for an event, and we went to the Reagan Library, and there's this great room in the Reagan Library dedicated to Gorbachev and Reagan, and it's them sitting just as two men, two grandpas. They're both grandfathers at that point in their lives, right? They're both dads, or, you know, kids are grown, but, you know, they both have grandchildren, talking to each other face to face. And I said to my wife, I said, that's what both of those gentlemen understood. They're both gone now, but they both understood that, okay, that if we don't talk to each other, we're representing tens of thousands of people that could be killed on either side. We can kill you 500 times, you can kill us 500 times. At the end of the day, nobody wins. You only need to be, you know, you only need one nuclear weapon and kind of destroy your day. And at the end of the day, those two guys understood that. And we need more people in politics and in the world that understand, let's just talk. And when you sit down at a table and talk to somebody, it's so different than when you're doing it through the media. You know, like you mentioned Bernie a few minutes ago. Bernie's got a lot of differences than RFK, but guess what? At the end of the day, they both think health's an important thing. And, right. And that people should have options in healthcare, and that we don't need 87 commercials that control our news.
Yeah.
Because what do we wind up with? We wind up with, you know, take this pill and, you know, sing a nice little song like that one commercial.
Run through the field and be happy.
Yeah, and but meantime, your hair is going to fall out. You're never going to go to sleep.
So bad.
You're never going to sleep, but it's going to cure this problem or that problem. And look, I'm not against people taking pharmaceutical things, by prescription from a doctor. But at the end of the day, what are the natural remedies? Ask yourself that. I'll give you one other fast example of my life, Chris. When I tore up the rotator cuff in my right shoulder a number of years ago, first doctor I went to said, you need total shoulder replacement surgery. I don't do that. You need to go to this guy. He gives me another guy's card, says, go call this guy. Well, at the time, I'm like 45, 46 years old. And I'm like, I don't think I want that. I go to another orthopedist here. And he gives me all of these stretches to do, physical therapy, eventually stem cells, you know, PRP. Okay. Well, guess what? Here I am, 64. You know, there's my shoulder. Okay. Now, I don't know if I had had the surgery, if it would have been better or worse, but here's what I know. I wasn't ready to have it. I didn't want to hear one size fits all. I wanted to hear, well, what else can we do? And we did these things, and this second doc turned out to be right. That's what I want in healthcare.
Yeah.
I want a doctor who says, hey, John, let's try all of these things. And if nothing works, we go to surgery. Or if nothing works, we go to meds. But let's try, let's try some of the natural things we can do. How about you change your diet? How about you eat more fruits and vegetables? That's not going to cure your shoulder, by the way. But you know, what if you do that?
You got a lot of inflammation. Something might.
That really won't hurt. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, I want to hear all of those options. Yeah. And of course, the final option is the surgery or the meds. So, and I think that's what most Americans, that's what we want to hear, is we don't want to always hear, you know, take another pill. And my God, some of these people in these nursing homes, they're on, you know, so many different medications. It's like they got to be canceling each other out or doing something. I mean, and half the time they don't even know what they're on.
And then you get side effects, you get pills for the side effects of those pills, and it's just this cycle. And I love, I'm such a proponent of natural medicine. You know, my listeners know that, you probably know that too. And so much of it too, like, comes back to mindset, like we were talking about, right? Like, the placebo effect is real. What you believe will cure you. So if you believe that you can fix your shoulder with exercises and stretching and maybe losing weight and, you know, all of these things, addressing inflammation in your body. You know, there's so many things. It's so much more likely to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's an exciting time. I really, really do hope, you know, RFK and, you know, all these people can bring a lot of change. I'm very hopeful.
I think he's already doing that. I think he's going to do a great job, that doesn't mean every single thing he says that I'll agree with or you'll agree with.
Totally.
Okay,
and
great.
So important to say.
Exactly. It's like, it's like nobody's got all the answers. That's the real point. But at least let's have dialogue. That's the real secret sauce, so to speak, is like, let's discuss these things.
You know? Yeah. I mean, it goes back to what you were saying earlier, where it's not just Democrats and Republicans anymore. It's there's super far right. There's super far left. And I don't know, like, I also love Bill Maher, and he's like, I haven't changed, but like my party's changed. Right. And it's so interesting. And I was also thinking about what you said. You said so many like gold nuggets. I was kind of like jotting down on the side, cause I was like, oh, I want to like highlight that for people. You were talking about like people need to sit down in real life and have eye to eye conversations, not just through the media. And even through, I mean, like this conversation's great. Like, you and I are comfortable doing this, where it's like you almost kind of forget there's listeners that are going to be happening. But there's something about being in someone's energy where you can really, where you can just empathize with them more, right? You can feel more compassion. You can kind of see things from their point of view more. So I think it's so important. It's kind of something we've lost a little bit, right? But I thought it was important you brought that up.
Well, I think like anything, I mean, you know, like the internet's great, but one of the things we've lost in business sometimes is we do everything, you know, on the internet, you know, by Zoom, by Riverside, by these other technologies, which are great because it does save a lot of travel expense. But there's still a great value to getting people in a boardroom and saying, hey, yeah, like as a company, for example, we've got these five issues. We've got these five opportunities. Let's talk about them. Let's whiteboard them. Let's, you know, what they call spitballing, right? Like, let's spitball them, so to speak, right? And then let's go out to lunch. And, you know, you three guys, you're experts in that, and you three are in that. And you guys come back, and at 2 o'clock, let's all present what our ideas are on this situation. There's still a tremendous value in there. I mean, I one of the companies I helped build here in Dallas back in the 90s, we would come in early in the morning and we would have these dialogues with a whiteboard, a huge whiteboard that covered an entire wall. And we would put so much stuff up there. And 9 out of 10 things we never did, by the way.
Right.
But at least it was like, okay, put your idea up there, Chris, and now defend it. Because I'm going to try to tear it apart, not because I want to tear it apart, but because I want, when the marketplace tries to tear it apart, I want you to tell me why you feel as strongly as you do. Give me your talking points, right? And that's how we would decide things. Well, we wound up building a $700 million company out of that company, okay? And you know, I look back on that, and I think some of the success that we had was because we were willing to get in there and fight for our position, not against another person, but here's why I think this will work, or for that matter, what you're saying, I don't think it'll work, right? So there's still a great value in that. So I would suggest to anybody, you know, whether you're running a small business, whether you're running a family business, you still have those meetings with the key players in your organization, because it's invaluable what sometimes comes, and sometimes what you miss, because sometimes you're just too busy. You've got too much going on and you miss the obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, not only do you get to like defend your ideas and have other people kind of like poke the holes in them, but you inspire other people, right? It's like your idea might make this other guy be like, oh my God, like piggybacking off of that, we could do this. And, you know, he would have never jumped to that before. So yeah, that's really great advice. You mentioned earlier you believe in God, and then you said you lived in Tel Aviv. Can I ask what religion you are?
Yeah,
you
follow religion? I was born Presbyterian.
Okay.
I was raised Presbyterian. I went to Church of Christ when I was 18 and considered actually becoming a minister of theirs.
Oh, wow.
As life has gone on, I was baptized as a Baptist here in Dallas. I've studied with Jehovah's Witnesses. I've studied with Seventh-day Adventists. I've studied the Bible with all sorts of things. But nowadays, I just go to a Bible church. I just figured, you know what? Denomination's great, you know, but there's politics even with them. So there's a local Bible church that I attend. The reason I was in Tel Aviv was business, believe it or not.
Okay.
The guy who I admit,
I believe it.
Here in Dallas, a Jewish guy, he had gone to Tel Aviv University, had started a business over there. And I left that company that became a $700 million company. And I was kind of on sabbatical. And he said, why don't you come over here and I'll pay you some money. And you'll get a chance to really see the Holy Land. So I spent 6 months over there in Tel Aviv. And it was fascinating. I used to watch the helicopters in the morning fly back and forth to the West Bank. It's the safest country in the world internally. What I mean by that is internally, it's really safe. Like
like no crime kind of thing?
Very little, very, very little. And now I haven't been there since the mid-90s, so maybe it's changed, but very, very safe in that respect. But of course, the perimeter, you've got a lot of enemies.
Not so safe.
You know, so yeah. It was interesting. I went to places like Joppa, for example, real Old Testament place. I went, I was all over Israel itself, but I also went over to Jordan a few times and also to Egypt. I spent time in both of those countries. I have friends still in both of those countries. It was a great opportunity not only to see the world, but to see biblical history. And the thing most Americans don't realize, and most Christians for that matter, when you go to Israel, you are walking and standing in history. And the Coptic Christians, which are a group that mostly is in the Middle East, there's some over here in the States, but Coptic Christians, they are the historians of all things biblical for the most part. So, for example, you go to where Christ was laid out in the tomb. Well, the rock that they laid him on is there. You can't touch it. You walk around it and look at it. And stuff, and these guys were actually kind of in charge of that. So it was terrific from that standpoint. Got a lot of Old Testament history as well, obviously. It was a fascinating time in my life. And then my mother got sick, and that kind of led me to my next business venture because I found a product out of McGill University that I became the chief architect of marketing for 29 years ago. So it's kind of weird. God had a different plan. I actually saw myself living in Israel the rest of my life. Because what people don't realize too with Israel, if you look on a map, I'm a New Yorker originally, so we tell people New York's the center of the universe. We're actually lying to them. Actually, Israel's the center of the universe. If you look at it, it's kind of like if you took a big map and you put it in your office, you'd see Israel's kind of right at the center of it, which I think is why so much of our history starts there. But it was fascinating. But I got to know people of all different faiths. And all different political persuasions, by the way, living in that part of the world, you know. And here's the funny part. We think as Americans, because of our news, again, everybody over there hates each other. You find a lot of people intermarried, okay? And you find a lot of friendships, okay? And then all of a sudden everything blows up because of a small group of people and they destroy everything on everyone else, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, so I have like 30 family members in Israel. I've only been twice though, but that was what was cool. Like, just to go off your point, what was cool about Jerusalem is it's like you have the Muslim quarter, you have the Jewish quarter, or I don't even, do they call them quarters? Because there's only three, and then the Christian area, but it's like everyone's sharing Jerusalem. You know, but yeah, I asked because I was thinking about what you said about like Iran versus Israel. And like, if we could only just like talk, and I've been watching The Chosen. Have you seen it yet?
Yeah.
And I admittedly like did not know the stories of the New Testament. I was brought up without religion. My dad's side of the family was Jewish. My mom's side was Catholic, but my parents decided like we weren't going to do that. And so I had no idea the stories, and I'm like kind of falling in love with Jesus a little bit. And I'm like, wow, I get it. Like, I get the whole, like, what would Jesus do? It's like such a great way to live your life. Right. But just something like that, like learning someone else's point of view just goes so far.
Oh, yeah.
And if all of these people could just do that, Because there's truth in all the paths, right? It's at the core of it, like all religion, all spirituality is, it's about love and oneness and you know, compassion and family and all of these things. And it's like, if we could just kind of read each other's books, right?
And you're absolutely right. And that was one of the things that I learned over there, was that there's different factions within Judaism, you know, for example. Okay. But it's like, what a beautiful religion. Okay. But a beautiful philosophy of life when you get into some of the Old Testament, you know, teachings, right? And likewise, of course, with the New Testament. But for that matter, too, you know, you talk to friends that study the Quran properly, not the interpretation some people have of it, but properly. Like, I've got a number of Muslim friends that are very up on it. And it's like, you know, if you look at the Ten Commandments, whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, non-believer, you want your kids to know things like thou shalt not kill? Yeah. Yeah, like killing people isn't really cool, you know, like it'll get you in trouble, it'll get you in jail or dead, right? Like, you know, as an example of things like that. So that's kind of what I embraced being over there. But it was so interesting to go to some of the historical sites, and I'll tell you the one that got me, Chris, more than anything else, and still gets me. Did you ever go to the place that they commemorate the children killed during the Holocaust?
No, I didn't.
I'm gonna.
But that would be really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? Yeah, especially as a young.
It's like making me tear up thinking about it.
I'll tell you what. I've got a pretty rough side to me, but it was tough to walk through there, because what they do is they got a candle for each child, and they actually are saying the child's name. So it's like they'll say the child's name or what country they were from, for example. And you walk out of there, and I didn't have kids at that stage when I was there. I met my wife a short time later. And point being, it's like, man, it just tears your heart out. And you're like, how did the world let it get that far?
Yeah.
You know, and we can never, and Jewish people have it right. We can never let that happen again. It's like, if you see it happening, you have to do something about it, you know? So in that respect, I think, you know, I'm not sure this current circumstance, I'm not commenting that way, but yeah, we can never let things get like that again. You know, it wasn't good for anybody. And you think what we lost, and I'll tell you something else we lost there that's interesting, because I study science a lot, is there were so many scientific inventions that the Nazis killed off. Okay, that were being created like at the Max Planck Institute, for example, in Germany, by a lot of Jewish scientists, that they just killed this stuff off. It's like the science never existed. Stuff that deals with things like cancer and all today, that these guys maybe had figured out in the 20s and 30s, for example. You know?
I didn't know that. I knew that Nazis themselves were really into like advancing science in like certain aspects, but I didn't know that they did that.
Unfortunately, they destroyed a lot of it at the end. It was kind of like the scorched earth, where they just destroyed everything, you know, and they did have advances, a lot of advances. But a lot of people, like, you know, Dr. Gershon came out of that period, wound up over here, and, you know, a lot of other great scientists that the United States wound up, you know,
took them all.
But how many were lost too? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not only Jewish, but anybody who opposed the Nazis that you know, were killed off, that were some of the most brilliant minds, because they were blessed. The German country was blessed with some very brilliant people, needless to say. Our space program, von Braun and all those guys, they were all, you know, they were all German scientists. So, you know, so yeah, some of them survived, but it's certainly the more you know history, the more you realize when you see some of the mistakes being currently made by humanity, it's like, guys, let's just stop this, you know?
Yeah, like we know where this goes.
Yeah, like we really have such an incredible time that we've been given. Let's take full advantage of it instead of doing some of the things that our ancestors did that didn't turn out well.
Yeah. Wow, John, this was a great conversation. What I love about doing these shows is I don't plan anything, and the conversation goes where it's going to go. And sometimes it doesn't work out as well, and sometimes it's just like a jackpot, and I don't even know what I'm going to title this episode. But I loved just your insights, and you're so easy to talk to, and I've already gone like 15 minutes over, so I want to respect your time. But thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm sure there's so many amazing takeaways listeners are walking away with, and I'm sure people want to know where to connect with you. So if you want to just take a moment and, just let people know.
Probably the best bet is, johnsolider.com, S-O-L-L-E-D-E-R. My name's right there. You can see it, johnsolider.com. You can reach me there. If you want to hear our podcast, okay, just it's on YouTube under John_Solider, but you can probably just Google it and get there as well. We originally called it Leave Nothing to Chance, but we kind of gotten away from that. We just kind of got it under my name now. We are on Rumble also. We haven't put that many shows up there, but those are the best places to get a hold of me. And yeah, whatever you want to talk about, folks, feel free to contact me. I love to talk to interesting people. And I'm always looking for great podcast guests too, Chris, like yourself. That's how you and I connected, you know. So anybody thinks, hey, I want to get on a podcast, contact me. Tell me about yourself. Let's see if we can get you on a show.
Yeah, you're a great podcast host. So go check out John's podcast. Again, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you today. An hour and 15 flew by. If you are listening and there's someone you think this would resonate with, send it to them. Like, comment, share, subscribe. Let's all help lift humanity up. Have a beautiful rest of your day, everyone.